is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Gazini. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Book 1, Chapter 3, Part 6. Even in those parts of the kingdom which at the close of the reign of Charles II were the best cultivated, the farming, though greatly improved since the Civil War, was not such as would now be thought skillful. To this day, no effectual steps have been taken by public authority for the purpose of obtaining accurate accounts of the produce of the English soil. The historian must therefore follow, with some misgivings, the guidance of those writers on statistics whose reputation for diligence and fidelity stands highest. At present, an average crop of wheat, rye, barley, oats, and beans is supposed considerably to exceed 30 millions of quarters. The crop of wheat would be thought wretched if it did not exceed 12 millions of quarters. According to the computation made in the year 1696 by Gregory King, the whole quantity of wheat, rye, barley, oats, and beans then annually grown in the kingdom was somewhat less than 10 millions of quarters. The wheat, which was then cultivated only in the strongest clay and consumed only by those who were in easy circumstances, he estimated at less than 2 millions of quarters. Charles Davenant, an acute and well-informed, though most unprincipled and rancorous politician, differed from King as to some of the items of the account, but came to nearly the same general conclusions. The rotation of crops was very imperfectly understood. It was known, indeed, that some vegetables lately introduced into our island, particularly the turnip, afforded excellent nutriment in winter to sheep and oxen, but it was not yet the practice to feed cattle in this manner. It was therefore by no means easy to keep them alive during the season when the grass was scanty. They were killed and slaughtered in great numbers at the beginning of the cold weather, and during several months even the gentry tasted scarcely any fresh animal food except game and river fish, which were consequently much more important articles in housekeeping than at present. It appears from the Northumberland Household Book that in the reign of Henry VII, fresh meat was never eaten even by the gentlemen attendant on the great earl, except during the short interval between Midsummer and Michaelmas. But in the course of two centuries, an improvement had taken place, and under Charles II, it was not till the beginning of November that families laid in their stock of salt provisions, then called Martinus beef. The sheep and the ox of that time were diminutive when compared to the sheep and oxen which are now driven to our markets. Our native horses, though serviceable, were held in small esteem and fetched low prices. They were valued one with another by the ablest of those who computed the national wealth at no more than 50 shillings each. Foreign breeds were greatly preferred. Spanish jennets were regarded as the finest chargers and were imported for purposes of pageantry and war. The coaches of the aristocracy were drawn by grey Flemish mares, which trotted, as it was thought, with a peculiar grace, and endured better than any cattle reared in our island the work of dragging a ponderous equipage over the rugged pavement of London. Neither the modern dray horse nor the modern racehorse was then known. At a much later period, the ancestors of the gigantic quadrupeds, which all foreigners now class among the chief wonders of London, were brought from the marshes of Welcheren, the ancestors of Childers and Eclipse from the sands of Arabia. Already, however, there was among our nobility and gentry a passion for the amusements of the turf. The importance of improving our studs by an infusion of new blood was strongly felt, and with this view, a considerable number of barns had lately been brought into the country. Two men whose authority on such subjects were held in great esteem, the Duke of Newcastle and Sir John Fenwick, pronounced that the meanest hack ever imported from Tangier would produce a diner progeny than would be expected from the best sire of our native breed. They would not readily have believed that a time would come when the princes and nobles of neighbouring lands would be as eager to obtain horses from England as ever the English had been to obtain horses from Barbary. The increase of vegetable and animal produce, though great, seems small when compared with the increase of our mineral wealth. In 1685, the tin of Cornwall, which had more than 2,000 years before attracted the Tyrian sails beyond the Pillars of Hercules, was still one of the most valuable subterranean productions of the island. The quantity annually extracted from the earth was found to be, some years later, 1,600 tons, probably a third of what it now is. But the veins of copper which lie in the same region were, in the time of Charles II, altogether neglected, nor did any landowner take them into the account in estimating the value of his property. Cornwall and Wales at present yield annually near 15,000 tons of copper, worth near £1.5 million sterling. That is to say, worth about twice as much as the annual produce of all English mines of all descriptions 17th century. The first bed of rock salt had been discovered in Cheshire not long after the Restoration, but does not appear to have been worked till much later. The salt, which was obtained by a rude process from brine pits, was held in no high estimation. The pans in which the manufacture was carried on exhaled a sulphurous stench, and when the evaporation was complete, the substance which was left was scarcely fit to be used with food. Physicians attributed the scorbutic and pulmonary complaints which were common among the English to this unwholesome condiment. It was therefore seldom used by the upper and middle classes, and there was a regular and considerable importation from France. At present, our springs and mines not only supply our own immense demand, but send annually more than 700 millions of pounds of excellent salt to foreign countries. End of part 6. Read by Grazini and Vallet.